剪了吗？你现在？
Good evening, very good evening to you.
I meet you formally?
My name is Olatunji Shotimiri. I am a performing artist, a musician, actor, play director, storyteller, a broadcaster, and a university lecturer. I actually teach in the Department of Creative Arts, University of Lagos. My area of interest or areas of interest include, you know, play directing, acting, theater, workshop, workshop on some, and, you know, music in the theater. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Let's start from the point where you just ended your introduction now. You talked about music, and I know I've seen quite a whole number of rock that you've done in the past. Death and the King's Osman, where I saw you as an actor, and then Rotimi is the Gods Are Not to Blame that you directed and was staged at the prestigious Muson Center. Now, for you, somebody who also has a band, who has, you know, developed his own brand of music, how would you describe music in tragic plays in relation to the play The Gods Are Not to Blame that you directed and Death and the King's Osman that you performed?
Of course, generally speaking, let me take it from the general use of music and relevance and essence of music in play production. Of course, to highlight, to identify areas where you want to capture the mood of the actor, and in doing so, you want also that to be translated into what could very well communicate the atmosphere, to involve the audience, members of the audience, and also to as it were, you know, enhance the moments where you have dialogue. Even moments where you don't have dialogue, music plays very significant role in communicating the importance of, you know, particular scenes or messages in the play. You know, music also can help to communicate the thematic preoccupation in terms of sometimes non-verbal messages to an audience. But specifically, the manner in which I use music in Gods Are Not to Blame, that was staged at the Muson Center, which was produced by the Thespian Theater, you know, some years back. I invited some professional artists who are usually, some of them don't traditionally play for theater productions. But you see, nowadays, theater is just, it's gone beyond just staging it. You want to look at how you can achieve and bring about the commercial viability of it. Therefore, one tried to introduce, you know, those that the audience, the public, already have identified with as popular musicians. For instance, I brought in Ara Lola, a female talking drummer. In fact, she's celebrated all over Africa as one of the foremost female talking drummers. She's done a bit of theater productions with Wanle Abimbola of the La Campagne Tropicana. So one cannot totally say that she's not exposed to theater. But specifically for that production, we had to make her do the traditional drumming, which was complemented by other traditional talking drummers, you know, the in order to one, I mean, for instance, the scene where we say there is war situation, and we made her to give us an atmosphere of war with the creation of beats that will palpitate the minds of people, that will create fear, that will cause, you know, that tension. And she did it quite well. And in moments where you had the naming ceremony, she also was very effective. And we made her compose, you know, songs and phrases specifically relevant to celebrate, you know, naming ceremony. And moments where you had tragic situations where, you know, the announcement came that, look, you would marry your, you will kill your father and then marry your mother. You know, a different type of music, which sort of, you know, that brought about that melancholic mood, was also explored. So in those kind of situations, music came in as a very effective tool to render, okay, the message in very clear traditional expressions to communicate the message of the play. Yeah.
Now, you said something about using Ara.
Yes.
As a talking drummer to introduce the play and the rest of them. Mm. It does appear that Olaretunmi has written the play in such a way that it is told by a narrator.
That's right.
So you're saying that Aralola was the narrator there, or she complemented the role played by the narrator?
Yes. You know, with every production, what one tries to do is to bring some kind of fresh innovation and perspective to it. Just like you rightly said, the narrator was there. I mean, in fact, working with the Thespian family was, you know, the woman, Mrs. Jayesimi, who produced the play, Ayo Jayesimi, I mean, from a very, you know, rich and a serious Christian background, wanted us to, as it were, not delve too much into traditional cultures. So what we tried to do was to create a sense of balance. So Ara Lola's drumming at the, you know, prologue, where you had narrator. In fact, narrator, you know, comes into that play at, you know, intermittent moments, and those moments were highlighted, so complemented by either mood music in the background or to announce scenes or situations that will come immediately after, you know, one particular moment. So Ara Lola was there, one, to do her virtuoso drumming, to showcase her skills, but within the confines of traditional understanding of a Yoruba play. So like you said, she complimented, in spite of those very moments where some moments or situations where she had to do solo performance in the company of other backup drummers. Yeah, you know what I mean, in the talking drum family, in the Dundun family, it's not just one person. It's not a one person show. Although she played the lead talking drummer, you have the Konongo, the Gudu Gudu, the Yalu, you know, the Atele, and all the rest of those drums, you know, they were there to give it a sense of completeness in projection of those messages. Yeah.
Yeah. So now, apart from it appears from what you're saying now that music was really central to your directorial approach.
Absolutely.
Now, what other
types of music deployed in the
basically so that we can have a feel,
a broader you know knowledge of it. I would say also that at some point where you know the for instance there's the Fuji music that of course developed from the Were tradition where Muslims would wake up in the middle of the night after to break their fast. We experimented with that by playing the Sakara music in order to appeal to another type of audience, because what we try to do with that play is to reach out to the old, the young, and you know even those, even though it is focused, it emphasizes the traditional, you know, general orientation of the play. But then we also want to emphasize the fact that look, in this age and time, the youths must be taken along. Those who have gone to schools, those who are the elites must be taken along. So we created me. That didn't mean that we brought in guitar. No, we didn't bring in all those modern instruments. But then the Fuji music, the manner in which it will appeal to modern day audience was also experimented with, and it worked. In an environment like the Muson Center, most of the time you have highbrow, you know, people, elitists, you know, kind of. But then we broke it down. Of course, the dialogue is in English. So, but no matter what, those who came to watch the play when it was announced when the promos were running, knew that they were coming to see a traditional play. But then we gave it a kind of dimension that will appeal to contemporary period in terms of the appreciation of the various tools of engagement, of music, of poetry, of chant, of incantation, of even rendition by the priests, you know. We try to break it down and complement with the appropriate dance movement so that it will be a robust, you know, spectacle, you know, to those who came to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. We understand that it is almost impossible not to have some kind of choreography when you have music, especially in a play like this.
Yeah.
Now, how were you able to integrate the music with the choreography, and what sort of dance steps were actually choreographed for the performance?
That's right. Okay, fine. Let me take certain scenes. For instance, the priests. We try to make the priest have an acolyte, you know, some kind of apprentice who would take him around wherever he needed to go. In fact, we didn't just make the priests and his assistant come on stage without having to have add color and and choreography to their movement, you know. So I'm trying to remember the specific songs that was composed. So if, for instance, I mean, this is just an example, and I hope that's what we use. If we say if I jing jing if I mobile or con JJ, you see, the choreography complemented the singing, and it became a very, you know, colorful moment that the audience, you know, who may not understand what you're saying, but they can move along. I mean, if you do that kind of show in a place like Brazil or Mexico, you know, you see this the sense of movement in terms of choreography, you know, because there's a specific way in which you have a priest who is considered and seen to be elderly will move, but we gave the priest a specific movement to suit his age, and the assistant, in fact, we have two assistants with him who also complemented his movement. So choreography became a tool, okay, to engage the audience in a very, very, you know, a pleasing manner. So, and apart from the priests, you had the war situation. It was not just presented as a war or a state or a situation where you had enemy, the laws and broken down and all of that. But we organized it. In the middle of those crises, there was order. You know, we had different factions, different groups. In fact, to even bring to bear or to the fore the kind of political you know, crisis that we have in contemporary times, where you have factions, you know, one group attacking the other because of a particular interest, you know. So all of those things were factored in to say, look, let's design. It was deliberately designed, okay, it was coordinated in a very organized manner that, you know, one could say that, look, this is a particular group attacking the other and with good singing to complement the dance movement. So those were the war situations. But then again, the celebrative moods too were choreographed. You see, you had different with the family of Odewale, Aderokpo, all the chiefs. And the townspeople, for example, when the king announces to say, listen, go there, and when they came to complain that, you know, they are sad, they have been, you know, struck by all kinds of ailments and diseases, and the man says, listen, look at me, I'm also sick, look at my children, you know, they are feeling the same pain that you go through. By the time he gives them some kind of assurance that, you know, if they go to the bush to, you know, get some herbs, they would, you know, there will be some level of improvement in their lives. From that moment on, a different type of mood, you know, was registered, and it was it was hopeful. So the kind of drumming and choreography that introduced at that moment, you could title it, you know, hope. So and you know, one at that point in time, you saw celebration, you saw hope, you saw, you know, people who had been dejected going, you know, to town giving assurance by their leader to say go. So so drums, music, choreography came in intermittently in the place. So like you said, music plays very significant. In fact, some moments there were some moments in the play where, you know, like I said, you know, it was just chanting that registered the essence of that scene. You know, when, you know, for instance, the Ade Rokpo's mother had to wail and cry and became emotional, you could feel the pain, the pang of a troubled mother. Okay, so I've been sleeping with my son, you know, that sort of thing. And it was not just dialogue, it was singing, complementing the dialogue at that moment. So, you know, that's the way we were able to handle that.
Okay, the girls are not to blame, have been directed and performed many times.
Yes.
But I recall that there was this innovation that you introduced.
Yeah.
And that's the area of multimedia.
Yeah.
What prompted the choice?
That? Yeah, okay.
What informed the choice of multimedia?
I would say that, you see, in most, like you said, people have had several interpretations. But I think the producer, Mrs. Jai Simi, also was of the opinion that, look, this land of Kutuje, it's a small community, but then let's look beyond Kutuje. Let's try to represent the mass of generality of the people who occupy different. So what the multimedia was able to achieve was to see them maybe at the doing, engaging in different shores, the river side, the farms, some cooking, making their gari and food and stuff like. So on stage you may not be able to achieve that, particularly with the limited, time and space. Gotcha. But with the multimedia, we're able to marry all of those moments and situations. I mean, the River Rhine area, the cooking bit, the, some young men trying to woo ladies and stuff. So we were able to sort of get into those areas that ordinarily we would not have been able to achieve if we tried to present it. In fact, we even went to a large expanse of farmland, so where you had was it Bonka now, or trying to discuss
the encounter between Adetusa.
Yes, so that way people were able to, connect to the reality of, a natural environment, as opposed to what you try to recreate on stage.
Sure. So let's go back a little bit. I realize that unlike some other professional productions that I've seen, your cast was largely made up of young people.
Yeah.
Well, what was
responsible for that? I will say that, let me say that this was prompted by the producer who was trying to target the youth, okay, and to say, look, let me inject into this production the spirit of, youthfulness, the spirit of the youth, okay. And again, if you look at it politically, they say it's not too young to rule. You understand me? So we are saying that, okay, these are the early ones. They are still very much relevant. But then the younger ones are the ones who take over. Let's start to build them. For as long as they have the capacity to carry the roles. Well, you could also, observe that, yes, we had people like, Lijadu, Ayo Lijadu, and a couple of elderly ones in a, who in a way carried the younger people along. So that is to say, in a way, the philosophy behind all that is to say, look, let us take these youths along, because they will ultimately be the ones, okay, to lead this community in future. And I think that's the reason why. And again, the producer wanted more, because most people who go to theaters, from the youth category, from the young people, they are the ones who go to theater. These are the only ones, you don't have too many of them.
Yeah, but I was thinking actually in the direction of the fact that I saw the performance, I was part of it.
Yeah.
The dances that you mentioned.
Yeah,
but actually, really energetic, especially the war scene.
Yeah,
my opinion would have been that the casting was mainly to bring in these young people that are very strong.
Yeah.
Because unlike so
and
many
energetic, yeah.
versions of the play that I've seen, that particular one was really, really, really energetic because the music was so top notch and the choreography was really solid.
Yeah.
To the extent that some members of the audience imagine that, unlike the girls are not to blame,
that they had seen,
is that some kind of pace?
That's right.
But was that a deliberate thing to pace up the action?
Yes, it was, because traditional plays sometimes can be boring if you don't inject something that will sort of titillate, you know, members of the audience to keep them on their toes. You see, in modern times, if people get distracted, the next thing they will do is to pick their phones, you know, and be pinging, and be sending messages. But we had to ensure that we didn't allow all of that to happen by engaging them with appropriate music, dances, and good acting, you know, that will lift the spirit of the audience for every... In fact, the acting, you know, people like Olaru Timi, who came in the, you know, much later into the play, who played, you know, Odewale Ayolijadu, that, of course, elderly. But then we told him that, look, pace will be of essence in this particular production. You know, Shafi, who is very much celebrated in the home video industry, came in to bring her expertise as a performer and a regular in the home video. In fact, it was, like you said, a celebration of, you know, people from different backgrounds. You know, the elderly ones, even the drummers, understood. They had a lot of energy and added value to the new orientation that we're trying to achieve. So, and I think, you know, in a way, it was well accepted, and it registered a great deal of significance in the minds of the audience.
Yes, in terms of the costume, I noticed that generally you see subscribe to, you know, the traditional costume.
That's right.
Ashoke.
That's right.
Yeah, but considering that you also wanted a play that has a lot of pace and energy.
Yeah.
You don't think that's a bit out of maybe a kind
contradictory,
of,
if you like.
In a way.
Now, let me say that there is no way that you can completely shy away from something that is traditional. Again, in trying to toe the line or respond to the request of the producer, Mrs. Jaisimi, yes, she's a Christian, but then she also wants to explore, you know, something that is rooted in the Yoruba tradition. So, in fact, she actually chose, you know, those costumes to say, look, this is Agbada that will befit a proper king in the Yoruba land.
The producer was also the costumier.
Absolutely. She was the costumier. She actually, you know, chose those costumes to say, look, in spite of the fact that I want it to appeal to modern-day audience, they must also know that we have a history. We have an identity, a culture. So that was why, you know, she, you know, had to use those costumes. I mean, for every character, there's a defined, you know, designed, purposeful costumes. Okay, to say, look, this is your character, you are old. And for people like Aderopo, of course, but, you know, if they had to go to the farm and all of that, there was some kind of thing that would suit them to wear to go and work on the farm. So we had those traditional things. So that was the purpose, to represent tradition.
Yeah, I know that you, like you said, you are a composer and a musician. The songs, the music that you use for the production, did you compose them yourself?
I did compose some of those songs, and I also encouraged, because as a director, what I realized was that most of the singers that we brought in, people like Funmi Abe and her brother, Abe, I can't remember his first name now, it's also Abe,
Shehun
Abe, and they came in With the mindset that, look, this they work with national troop, and they are familiar with a lot of Yoruba songs. So they just felt that they would just be injecting those songs that they knew. I said, no. What I wanted was to bring, you know, some kind of freshness into songs, composition in play productions.
So they were made to compose.
They were meant to compose, apart from the ones that I, you know, composed, but they were meant to. So Fumi, you know, responded very well and composed some new songs.
But what guided these compositions?
Yeah.
What guided it?
Of course, you know, the philosophy, I mean, if you remember, what we tried to highlight in the play was the statement of the fact that there are some kings who would want to stay and stick to or power, but then they have some destinies and fate that have been designed, you know, perhaps by, you know, some means, will not allow that. So it will offset whatever plans that they had. So all of these things guided the musical compositions, the choreography, everything. So those were the issues that we looked at in trying to compose, you know, new songs. And we didn't veer away, you know, from that philosophy of, okay, fine, here is a new political agenda, a new set of people occupying governance, you know, in our community, in our society, in our country. Well, then you can't be. You see, when you become authoritative, too powerful, there must be some kind of motivation behind all of that. It may not be deliberate. It may be something that is innate, that is that you don't know. So not until someone, you know, sort of calls your attention to it. So these are things that we're able to throw up in trying to project the play's philosophy. And that guided the direction of the singing, of the dance, of acting, of character interpretation.
Okay. In relation to Death and the King's Husband,
yeah,
it's another tragedy. Now, how would you describe tragedy and what is tragic? Let's look at it. Let's take it from the gods are not to blame, then Death and the King's Husband, and then we'll look at it in specific reality.
Let me start with the gods are not to blame in terms of the tragic import and what that portends in an African environment. There are times when people, Olarotimi clearly, you know, states it in the play. Yeah, a matter of, it could be destiny, depends on how you interpret it. But majorly, there are times when you want to defend the integrity of your family, of your culture, of your environment, of your the identity that you think you stand for. And you want to enforce it, even as a ruler. You know, and you probably don't know about your past. And in Gods Are Not to Blame, Odewale, for instance, you know, became, you know, authoritative. He would dish out instructions, and people would wonder, okay, fine, he's a warrior, you know, someone that is highly respected on the war front, even the home front. And then, but some of those decisions, he didn't know why he was doing it, but he just felt that, listen, as a leader, this is what happened. But those things were inherent in his persona as an individual. He didn't know it's in his blood. His blood, like one of the priests, you have a hot temper, you know. You have a hot temper. Is it that Laka that told him, you know, one of the characters? So, and it can be a human nature, a temperament that you, perhaps it's something that is endemic in your family, but then it's a tragic thing if it is not well managed. Yeah, and that's the thing that brings a lot of crisis into some families, some nations, you know, some societies. When you're rash, the military regime has that capacity to impose draconian rules on people because it is the oriented mentality that they have. But in the case of Odewale, from my own observation and research and understanding of his character, I want to think that it is just a human element, you know, in him. So, but he couldn't manage it. He became so downcast at the end of the play when it was, you know, the eyes were gouged and all of that, and you know, of course, all of that, you know, it's like something in the Bible when, you know, the hair had been shaved. He became powerless, and that's what happened to him. And that's a tragic. But so the metaphor in that is, you know, yes, as much as you want to take decisions, rule your people with all the power and the knowledge that you have, there are times where you don't just look at things from one direction. You have to be able to balance, you know, your decisions and temperament. He couldn't handle that. And some nations are suffering that, you know, I mean, Idi Amin and the rest of them, which other ones now? These very draconian rulers in African nations, and you know, they have that kind of temperament. So that brings about the tragic. So you saw at the end of the day how it sort of a tick, because it's a communal tragedy. Yeah, because I mean, look at all the family. You know, the children, you know, didn't have a choice but to go with him wherever he directed them. So it wasn't an individual, it became a communal problem. And that also is similar to what happens in Death and the King's Horseman by, you know, Wole Soyinka. It's interpreted to be something like, what do you call it, you know, how do I put it now? Something that is, well, it's tragic, it's sad, but there is a particular word I'm trying to remember in terms of describing the communal nature of the loss of power, of, you know, the essence of putting, of sustaining a tradition. And once you lose that sustainability of a traditional system, you allow, the Yoruba say that, because of the weakness of, you know, Eleshinoba, for instance, there is a kind of penetration of, you know, foreign interests, which, you know, sort of brought about in some ways, you know, the havoc that was wrecked, that actually wrecked, you know, him. Even though some of these things were his own personal decisions and were, you know, spurred or inspired by his, you know, lust for, you know, carnal things, you know. So we can look at it
okay.
From different ways.
Okay, so what you are saying is that if you consider the gods are not to blame,
yeah,
and Death and the King's Horseman,
yeah,
are tragedy,
yeah,
we're saying that tragedy generally, yeah, is a reflection of people and society.
Absolutely, absolutely, because it's always good to put it against the backdrop of what one experiences in the social environment that you find yourself. And when you talk about leaders who exhibit or demonstrate this capacity for or propensity for irresponsibility, there's a way in which it brings about some kind of tragic falls in their lives, and subsequently it affects the society that they found. I mean, look at Abacha. Today we are still suffering the lute and the kind of harsh, you know, nature of that government. You know, the military rulers, you know, even some of the politicians who amass money and stuff like that, who don't care. There's a way in which it's not all the time that when you kill or when you maim, that should be looked at as tragedy. The fact that the economy in itself is bad because of your mismanagement, because you siphon money, because you don't provide good health facilities, because you don't provide good roads. I mean, if you look at, if you link it to showing cars the road again, it's bad management, you know. So when potholes are there, an accident will happen. So it's bad governance, and it's tragic because you are there. Also, it will now mean that individuals have got to now fend for their lives. When there is no electricity, people have got to go and look for a generator. And in doing that, they may just cause more harm. You know, petrol tankers will move on the roads. It will just explode. And it will cause natural and national disaster for those who didn't plan. So it's about leadership. If the leaders put things in the right you know, place, then it would reduce the tragedy that people, you know, will encounter at the end of the day.
But then, if you look at it critically, sometimes, almost all the time, the tragic situation, the tragedy that we see, may not necessarily have to be the ones that are caused by those in power. How about those
who are governed, common people? Yeah.
So, in that sense, to what extent can we say that a play like The Gods Are Not to Blame also reflect the way people
respond to their leaders and
people respond to the tragic situation, or are even responsible for the tragic situation?
To start with, again, the common person is a member of a society, just as the leader who is not common, or, you know, is a member of a society. So they both are, you know, in the same society. It's just that the capacity of opportunities that are different. But if we are saying that, look, or not, all the blame should not go to the table of the leader. Some of these blames or problems can be caused by common people. Yes, it's the same human nature, but I think one is stronger than the other. For instance, the Boko Haram thing, you want to investigate what exactly is the cause of Boko Haram. What exactly is the cause of kidnapping? What exactly is the cause of several groups, okay, insisting that they must have their say, they must have their voice, they must have, the Shiite group and stuff like that, Shawori and the rest of them, they are now, you know, creating factors to say, look, we must dislodge this government. So those are individuals against leadership because they feel that things are not well. It's not an African issue alone. It's a global issue.
Like the West.
I mean, yeah, they have, but they just, it may be a psychological. People have different issues, problems. Even when you are satisfied, you have everything provided for you, you just feel like, look, this society is, I'm fed up. It can be a psychological problem. Okay, that may cause the disharmony or harm in any environment. So, if we take the African environment, for instance, most of these issues are caused by leaders. Some other tiny issues caused by people and that because of perhaps frustration. I mean, look at the example of lecturers who have been accused of sexual immorality and all of that. I don't think that the government is the cause of that one. That's an individual problem. So if you relate it to a psycho-emotional problem, that people can't manage. That, I think, is responsible for that. And that is affecting development of it. If the youths are affected, and maybe a student gets pregnant for you, and he or she cannot continue, or she cannot continue her education, that is causing some kind of stagnation in the life or career of that person. And emotionally, that family is going to face chaos and crisis. That's an individual problem. It's not a leadership issue. The leader, I mean, so it is both ways. But if you look at it broadly, for instance, they say workers are clamoring for, you know, better pay in Nigeria. What do you call it? Salary increase. Wages, you know, so what do they call it now? There's something about
end allowance.
Yeah, that's for you. End allowance, that's for you. That's I'm even saying generally in Nigeria, the minimum wage. Look, some people, whatever they earn, that it is not even enough to take them home. That's another problem. Okay? That's on the part of government. But on the part of the individual, some people have a lot. They pay themselves, they are rich, they are, you know. But then they see siphon money from banks, from oil companies. They, you know, look at our politicians. Look at our, you know, people in the Senate, House of Assembly and stuff like that. They earn a lot. Yet, they still want to amass some money and siphon. Look, so huge corruption can cause disharmony in any... So it is tragic, because at the end of the day, there's no way it will not affect the development of it. It's not, like I said, it's not only when it involves death that is tragic.
So you think tragedy like the gods are not to blame, actually highlights in a very strong way the crisis that society is facing.
Yes, it's a reflection.
You
see, it may be set in a traditional Yoruba environment, but it is a metaphor to express an opinion that no matter where we find ourselves in the world, human nature, human minds work in the same ways, whether you are white or black. So, in the gods are not to blame. It's a very interesting drama in terms of twists of fate, in terms of reaction by even the common people and all. But because they want to respect the status quo, they may not want. But at some point, that is why we have people occupy some positions of authority. The priests, Baba Fakule, a custodian of culture. He knows. He has deep knowledge.
Yeah, you said something about faith.
Yeah.
But what I recall of your directorial approach is you try to move a little bit away from that conception of faith.
It must be faith.
Rather than trying to emphasize human action.
Absolutely.
Human
action. I'm going to remember that.
Being responsible for
whatever decisions, actions that you engage. Yeah, that's. I'm just trying to. Now you've just, sort of reminded me. Yeah. But truly, yes, still it's an individual thing. And I always say that even if I find myself in a position of leadership, I mean, every soul has one weakness or the other, or one strength or the other. Baba Fakunle, as I was saying, has been around. He knows. If I even served various leaders in that society, in that community. So for Odewale to be arguing with him, he didn't want to listen to the truth. He probably feels that it's so insulting for a blind man to tell him the truth. If a Ganifa were him, Falano, and all these human rights activists who attack in the sense of try to redirect the might of some leaders, and they don't want to listen, then there is problem. Because, I mean, Fela, in his human rights activism as a musician, used his music as a tool to warn government. That's an individual. In the same manner that Baba Fakule is warning or warns Odewale. So these are people who have voices in their little, you know, ways. But the voices are being suppressed. Some people don't want their voices suppressed. That's why they can, you know. But Fela was suppressed. Gani was suppressed because he shouted till he went into his grave. He was arrested several times. And that's the thing. Sowore is then now suffering. Soyinka was arrested. Soyinka was jailed, you know, for saying the truth. In fact, he was going to be killed. He had to travel. He had to disguise. You know, Tinubu and the rest of them. So, there are voices who are speaking in order to say, look, let's have a sense of order. Let's give welfare. Let's this society will be better than this. If we could only do this and do that. So it's not only the leaders, like we said. Yes, there are some people there who don't want it to, because, I mean, look at it. Some people, perhaps they are the ones funding, for instance, generator have been imported, because some people have made up their mind that there should be no electricity in this country anymore. So, it's a very complex situation, but at the same time, there's no way. I mean, like, going back to Soyinka again, when he wrote The Road, this is a bit of digression, but it's important in terms of in trying to bring the tragic essence to the discourse. Yeah, he personally, as an individual, felt that the two people were dying on the roads. So he volunteered, look, let us set up some kind of, you know, organization
to take care of
road accident. So he rode the road. Even after all that experience, he rode the road. Okay, so but the whole idea was the concept, they tried to listen to him and stuff, but they stifled it.
Now, sir, let's take it from the example of Soyinka's tragedy, The Road. At a point in time, Rotimi mentioned that he wrote The Gods Are Not To Blame to decry the very ugly aspect of our tribal affiliation. That the play opened in 1968, right in the middle of the Nigerian Civil War. And if you look at it very well, now the tribal sentiment is even very deep. So, are you saying a play like The Gods Are Not To Blame, the tragedy that he dramatizes, or that he dramatized in his own 1978, are you saying the play is as much relevant to the Nigerian situation now, that is more divided by tribalism, than when the play even premiered? More than 50 years.
The issue of tribalism. I mean, you have cited an example of, you know, the of a national, the nationalistic kind of culture, that you have a national identity on, and that's a problem. It's very hard for us to say here is a national identity.
The tribal
sentiments have actually split us as groups. This is why every time people discuss, let us go our separate ways. It's because we have not been able to come together. But at some point, we lived as one family when we had the, you know, when we were still operating or existing as regions, regional governments. Regional. Then the tribalism was not really that pronounced. But then, when it became, look, let the Yoruba be the ones who are leading, let Igbo, let Hausa, forever. Listen, everywhere you walk, whether it's in transport business, whether it's haberdashery, whether it's technology, the issue of tribalism, ethnic bias, is always there. And when you want admission for your children, they will say, look, are you Hausa, are Igbo? You know, so that they have created the platform and forum to say, go to the north, go to the south. If you are coming to an area, they say, look, we don't have your whatever, this thing for you. There's no space for you. So instead of, in other climes, once you are qualified, they don't want to know where you come from. Well, you know, some people may be, because everything that happens in Nigeria, there's a replication, there's something, everywhere. You see, okay.
Before this xenophobia in South Africa, we have some aspects like that.
Yeah.
The Boko Haram.
Oh, yeah, it's happening. So the tribal thing is a human issue. To get people appointed or promoted in some universities, institutions, and stuff like that, even media organizations. Why should he be the one? It's not from it. Bring your CV, because I know you are Yoruba man, and I want you to be there even when I'm leaving. I think it will be, it won't be a bad idea to make you the head, because in order to sustain that tradition, so that when I want to come and bring somebody next time, you'll be the one to help me.
So, sir, what it means is that even when Rotimi says his play talks about the Civil War, to some extent he was even just being modest. This idea of tribalism, favoritism, eating deep into every facet of Nigerian society.
If you want to, like Oshofison would, using it to say, fine, let's do away with all of that. Let's look at things objectively from afresh, rather than the traditional way of looking things. If you want to do that, there's a way in which you are stifled. Your ideas are stifled. We know a lot of people who have objected to this at different times and occasions. Writers have written about the, you know, Soyinka and the rest of them, you know, Olarotimi, like you said, but they don't want to give them voice. They don't want to celebrate all of that. So what happens in a situation where, you know, you don't, your voices are sort of suppressed. You can only do what is within your limits, and that's the thing. So in going back to Gods Are Not to Blame, the title itself is neither here. It depends on how you interpret it. It's not as if it's the gods who have the problem. It is actually us. So the gods represent tradition, right? So, in other words, in trying to say, look, let's move on with life and create a new life for ourselves, we have to do away with a lot of things that have been endemic in our lives. Rawlings, for instance, Jerry Rawlings, in Ghana, took a revolutionary attitude. That was how there was some kind of breathing space in Ghana. You could see some development when he was there as a ruler, because he had to, like the Ogun, creating path for new idea by eliminating some people, you know. So you had to, it just had got to happen, and that's the revolution. So So it is not the gods that should be blamed. It is actually the people who, you know, are the custodians, who want to stay forever and say, this is how it should be. No, it shouldn't be like that. No, it's not your turn, it's our turn. No, it's give a chance, give opportunity to those who are qualified, who can do it. And it's the same problem that we are facing. So it is not the gods that are to blame, really, if you investigate properly. I mean, that's my own opinion. I mean, so it is the individual mind, the conscience that should be blamed. Because if we all think along the line of let's development, which most of the writers have propounded all this why, whether it's in also in Casper, even on Larry Timmy and the rest of them, it is about look, let us, yes, we are using the platform of Jobison, using folk tale, tradition, songs, music, and all of that to say, let us stop, you know, the oppressing ourselves, give opportunities to those who can do it.
So that's another aspect of the tragic situation in the country.
Yeah.
When people are oppressed, when they are denied opportunity, when they are okay. Thank you so very much for this interview. I really appreciate meeting you this very late in the night. Thank you so very much. I really appreciate the time. I'm sure you were talking about it well over 5 years.
Yes.
It's amazing that you're still able to remember.
You remember some of these things. And one I've done quite a lot more. Yeah. Even after that. So
thank you so very much.
It's a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.